Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Welcome to the brightest audience in the country. I'm Fred Williams, host of Real Science Radio.
And I'm Doug McBurney, the host of the Weekly Worldview. It's great to be back, Fred. And what is that that I see in your hand that you just got in the mail?
I got in the mail a book by Ellen McHenry. This thing is so cool. It's a proof copy. It's a pre-release of her book titled 20 Reasons to Question Plate Tectonics. I've already thumbed through it. I can't wait to read it. But man, there's a lot of images to go along with a lot of text to explain the problems with plate tectonics. And she has 20 reasons. And as we've talked before, there's more than that, but this is really going to be the really 20 really good reasons why people should question plate tectonics. I'm really thrilled to have a pre-release copy. And when this thing actually hits the press, where the public can have access to it, we'll be sure to add this to the RSR store. So be looking for that. I'm so thrilled to have this book, and I appreciate Ellen McHenry sending me a pre-copy. So today,
by the way, Fred, that's an indication that you are a powerful force in the world of creationism, in that you get to review a pre-publication copy of Ellen McHenry's dissertation.
Yeah, and RSR, we broadcast from KLTT's 50,000 watt blowtorch out of the Colorado area to our fabulous listeners. I can't wait for our listeners to be able to get access to this book. We've been talking about the hydroplate theory for a long time, about problems with plate tectonics. This thing is going to be a really good summary of these arguments, and with references to scientific articles. I think the public's going to love this book. So, Doug, we have been doing a series on Barry Setterfield's cosmology theory. It really helps explain why we see distant starlight. So I want to bring back on air so that we can finish this series up. I want to bring back Joe Spears. He's an expert on Barry Setterfield's cosmology. He's also been instrumental in the background of RSR, helping us out as we prepare for shows, do our research. He's been on the research team for many years, going back to when Bob Inyart and I was doing Real Science Radio. He's maybe the smartest guy I know, so I'd like to welcome back to the RSR airwaves, Mr. Joe Spears.
Well, thank you, Fred. Glad to be here.
Yep, and again, Joe, thank you so much that you've done for Real Science Radio, and I'm looking forward to doing part four of this show, and we're going to talk about the criticisms against Barry Setterfield's theory. It's always good to examine everything from every angle and see what the critics have to say about the theory.
Absolutely, and so I have to thank Joe for directing my attention to Setterfield's plasma astronomy, plasma cosmology. I was not familiar with this, Fred, less than a year ago. It was all new to me, and Joe gave me some suggestions and mentioned the name Barry Setterfield. And I went online to do some research and find out who is this guy that Joe is telling me I should know more about. So I go to YouTube and I type in Setterfield cosmology, or maybe I typed in plasma astronomy. And what comes up is, well, just a great one-hour video that we'll link to in the summary on rsr.org. And I watched Setterfield and learned all about this. But then the ever-reliable big tech algorithms directed me to criticisms. And one of the criticisms, the very first one that came up, was a fellow called Professor Dave on YouTube.
Yeah, I remember seeing that.
Professor Dave and his, I think the title is Debunking the Electric Universe, is the title of the video that YouTube directs anyone who's looking into Setterfield's cosmology. They get served up with Professor Dave and his debunking of the electric universe. And so what Professor Dave helped me learn was that I should be very cautious about anyone claiming to be debunking anything, because he debunked a whole bunch of stuff that had nothing to do with Setterfield's cosmology. And Joe, Professor Dave says he calls this pseudoscience that's not really accepted or supported by any actual real scientists.
Well, the father of plasma astronomy won the Nobel Prize. Hannes Alfvén got the Nobel Prize in 1970. He's not only the father of plasma astronomy, but he's also the father of magnetohydrodynamics.
Okay, so, he sounds like a real scientist, and he won the Nobel Prize right. before Barack Obama, back when the Nobel Prize actually meant something, right?
Back in 1970.
Yep.
Right, and in a field that's real. Yeah.
Well, one of his students is a big name in plasma astronomy, too. Anthony Peratt, who worked at Los Alamos National Labs, a PhD, and was the acting director for national security for the Nuclear Nonproliferation Directorate of the U.S. Department of Energy in 1998.
Wow. Wow.
And yeah, he's the guy who has those lab experiments that show how plasma can form galaxies. He's got like yes. miniature galaxies that we have on our webpage. Yeah. You can go look at those. We've got a link to that. It's really cool.
Yeah, he's the guy. And he's written a book on plasma astronomy too.
Yeah, so these aren't lightweights that Professor Dave, who looks like he's broadcasting from his mother's basement. You know, I'm sure he's got a bag of Cheetos and you know, Doug, I watched that video and about 10 minutes through it, I'm like, this guy, he totally discredited himself. And the reason why he did that was because he argued that people who support plasma cosmology, and he was actually attacking a different aspect of it, this electric universe, which is something slightly different, but it has aspects of plasma cosmology in it. Anyways, he was saying that they deny gravity. He spent at least 10 minutes talking about how these scientists don't even admit gravity exists. It was a complete straw man argument because of all the research I did when prepping for this show and talking with Joe about this over the last couple months, I never saw anything that indicated any of these scientists denied gravity. It's just really a falsehood. And so he spends a lot of his debunking, quote unquote, making this claim that they deny gravity. They don't deny gravity. They believe gravity does exist and it has maybe some role as a weak force, but the dominant force by far is plasma. Anyways, it was a straw man argument, and to me, it discredited anything else he was going to say. If you have to stoop to that, and that's your opening argument against it, is a straw man argument, that's not powerful stuff from Professor Dave in his mom's basement.
Yeah, and by the way, we will link to Professor Dave, because to be fair, we're not going to criticize the fella without letting people see the evidence for themselves. So we'll definitely link to that. And then
we'll cautiously link to him because I know from search engine optimization that actually helps him. But he's already ranking high. Google, their algorithms have already got him near the top for some reason.
Oh, they
he's
love
got
the
millions
guy.
Of
they
listeners.
Love the guy.
Yeah,
he's
they love
he's
him.
Got 2 million adolescent subscribers. So that, what can you say about the state of the world, right?
Yep, fellow Cheeto eaters.
But we're going to talk about a book that was written called The Electric Sky by Donald Scott. And Donald Scott is a PhD himself. Is that right, Joe?
Oh, yes. He's a retired professor of electrical engineering at the University of Massachusetts. And also, he's written a college textbook in electrical engineering. So he's not really a pseudoscientist. Just a little bit more I wanted to add about the book that Dr. Scott wrote. He wrote that book for the general public, not for scientists. And as such, it's not going to go into all of the rigorous scientific detail.
Yeah,
I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, he makes that point in his book. This was written for the general public. Right. And it's the book that Danny Faulkner wrote an article for Answers in Genesis that shows up really high in search engines criticizing plasma cosmology. And Faulkner spends most of his time trying to criticize this Dr. Scott's book. And again, we want to emphasize this isn't a pseudoscientist. This guy's an expert in electrical engineering. He's got a PhD. And he knows what he's talking about. And I wanted to talk about Faulkner's criticisms of it. Because, Joe, you wrote an article that isn't quite published yet. And just like Ellen McHenry's awesome 20 Reasons to Question Plate Tectonics, you've got an awesome criticism of Faulkner's article that's quite detailed, actually. You've done a really good job of laying out all the points where Faulkner is wrong on many cases. It's not just one or two things. It really shows a misunderstanding of plasma cosmology, and I was hoping you could expound on that.
Faulkner himself said that his review was largely a review of one book. So just to start there, you know, I don't think that I think the book's a good book, but even if it was a horrible book full of mistakes, it's one book. It's not the entire field.
Well, right. And Danny Faulkner, the title of his article is An Evaluation of Plasma Astronomy. It's not a book review of the electric sky. So that's somewhat misleading, but maybe unintentionally. But
to get into the science here, one thing Donald Scott talked about was that astronomers just don't understand some important concepts about electromagnetism or plasma physics. And Faulkner was saying, we do understand. Astronomers take courses in electromagnetism. And that Nobel Prize winner, Hannes Alfvén, wrote about this, saying that even textbooks for astrophysics do not even mention some of the most important basic concepts of plasma science. Now, this was the father of plasma astronomy who won the Nobel Prize. So, you know, I think he knows what he's talking about. And if those books don't even mention the concepts, and you add to that the fact that in a lot of college courses, the entire textbook is not covered.
Yeah, that's pretty typical.
And if you add to that, after 5 years after graduation, people have forgotten a large part of what they learned, then how can astronomers or astrophysicists really understand those basic concepts if they forgot a lot of what they learned, and if what they learned, if it wasn't even in the book? And then there are real examples. Yeah, you can find articles published by astronomers, and they actually mention things that don't exist, like open-ended magnetic field lines. Dr. Scott uses Maxwell's equations to show that there's no such thing as an open-ended magnetic field line, but astronomers talk about it. It seems like all over the place.
Wow. Yeah.
So that's what, Don Scott was saying. They really don't understand their electromagnetic theory. And that's not the only example. I could give more, but.
Yeah, there's a lot in your review of Faulkner's criticism. You know, one that stood out for me, and there's so many of them, there's a lot of problems with his review. But one is when he talked about that the material under consideration for the plasma has to be ferromagnetic. And when you read his bit on that, it just, to me, it showed really kind of a lack of understanding of what plasma cosmology is.
Oh, yes. You really do not need ferromagnetic material to have a magnetic field. Anytime you have an electric current, you always have a magnetic field. That's how an electromagnet works.
Exactly.
You have electricity flowing through the wire, and then that produces the magnetic field.
Yeah, because Faulkner, quote unquote, he said that it only works if the material under consideration is ferromagnetic. That's just an incorrect statement. That does show an ignorance of how magnetic fields work. Because like you said, all you need, if you have a current, you're going to have a magnetic field. That's basic science. I mean, that's, you're going back to Michael Faraday when he had that famous experiment he showed everybody in England about how that works.
Yeah, and do we have currents in the universe? This is where you think the universe is over 99% plasma, and I'm not talking about dark energy or dark matter. I'm talking about real
material.
Real matter.
Yep.
Yeah, and so that means over 99% of the universe is electrically charged particles. And they're in motion. I mean, the Earth's going around the sun, the moon's going around the Earth, the sun is moving around the Milky Way galaxy, and the Andromeda galaxy and the Milky Way galaxy are headed towards each other. I mean, everything is moving in the universe. And what's moving is electrical charge, and that is the definition of electric current. And that always produces magnetic fields.
Yeah, 100% of the time.
Yeah.
And if it didn't, then every time you drive your car over a sensor on the highway, then the light wouldn't know that, hey, you're sitting there. I mean, because I did that for a traffic light company. We developed traffic light control systems. And how did we make that work? we use the magnetic field and induction. There's a wire, inductive wire underneath the street. And so when your car drives over that, you change the magnetic field and it's going to produce a different voltage. And we're like, hey, there's a car there. So that works. I can guarantee you that works all the time. Unless there's like a bug in the code or there's a broken wire somewhere, that magnetic field 100% of the time works all the time. It's just a fact of science.
Yeah, and first of all, the solar wind is an electric current traveling through space, one thing. But here's a quote from that review we're talking about. The large distances and electrical neutrality of many objects involved render electromagnetic forces null. Electromagnetic forces dominate on atomic scales. Appreciable net charges can affect lab scales, but they cannot on galactic and cosmological scales.
Okay, that's a pretty big criticism right there.
So that's a quote from Faulkner.
Yes. So the thing about it is active galactic nuclei are shooting out jets of electric current. And here is a quote from an article that says, results have now yielded firm evidence that many, possibly all, AGN, active galactic nuclei, jets have inward currents along their axes and outward currents in a more extended region surrounding the jets. So we're talking about electric currents on a galactic scale.
Yes, and that totally refutes what Faulkner said. There's kind of an ignorance of what the actual evidence is out there.
Right. And in fact, the New Scientist website had a report on it, and I'll just quote from that. A cosmic jet 2 billion light years away is carrying the highest electric current ever seen, 10 to the 18th power amps, equivalent to a trillion bolts of lightning. 10 to the 18th would be
a pretty big number.
Thousands of trillions. It's big. Philip Kronberg, and continuing the quote, Philip Kronberg of the University of Toronto in Canada and colleagues measured the alignment of radio waves around a galaxy called 3C303, which has a giant jet of matter shooting from its core. They saw a sudden change in the wave's alignment coinciding with the jet. This is an unambiguous signature of a current, says Kronberg.
So it sounds to me like Danny Faulkner's fundamental criticism is based on a really fundamental misunderstanding.
Well, it's possible that these discoveries were more recent than what Faulkner's thinking about, you know.
Yeah, well, his article was 2013, but I can tell you right now he refers to that article on CRSNet to, you know, today, you know, recently, probably in the last month or two, he's referred to that about how he's refuted plasma cosmology. So he needs to be made aware of the fact that there's so much evidence against what he said. And, you know, you've mentioned some of these quotes. And again, I'm looking forward to having your article published. But I just want to requote what one of these astrophysicists found. They said, several researchers have reported direct evidence for large-scale electric currents along astrophysical jets. There's direct evidence that contradicts what Faulkner is saying. You couldn't be more clear. And this is just one, again, of I don't know how many examples of this that we find in his criticism that is just not factually correct.
And so, Joe, we don't have an unlimited amount of time, so maybe you can take us through some of the more significant criticisms or the ones most worthy of rebuttal.
Okay. One quote from Faulkner's review says, spiral structure of galaxies includes many stars that don't appear to be charged, so it is difficult to conceive how electromagnetic forces can move stars. Well, according to plasma astronomy, electromagnetic forces are not really moving stars into position. They form in the positions where they are. Like you mentioned the experiments of Anthony Perret, you know, the lab experiments showing galaxies forming. So when those galaxies form, you have a Z pinch, you have electromagnetic forces squeezing things together and things forming. And in a filament, in a plasma filament, you can have subfilaments that they can twist and twirl. So you think of subfilaments forming solar systems. One subfilament forms one solar system, another subfilament forms another solar system. But while it's a filament, there's no star there, there's no planet, but there's a pinch in the filament and it squeezes the matter together. And then even in the solar system filament, you can have subfilaments that form planets, and a central one may be forming the star. So stars are formed by the plasma processes in the positions where they end up. They're not forming somewhere else and being moved into position.
So Joe, it sounds like a misunderstanding that Faulkner has of, you know, how galaxies form, maybe based on something he's learned from, you know, as a secular viewpoint. He has a young earth view, no doubt about it. He's a good defender of the young earth position. He loves the Lord. We don't have any question on that. But it just sounds like to me that there's a misunderstanding that he has of how galaxies form. If you could maybe help explain that a little bit further.
I'm not sure if he understood that formation process that I just described, but even given that, electromagnetic forces, I would think, can actually move stars and actually do. And we have evidence that it does happen in galaxies. The galaxies rotate. And one of the big puzzles for astronomers is how to explain the rotation curves. And that's where dark matter is typically invoked to explain that. But if you consider electromagnetic forces causing the rotation of the galaxy, then what you see is what is expected. It's what the plasma effects would be, you know. You don't need dark matter. So the plasma forces are actually moving, causing the rotation of a galaxy and moving thousands of stars, millions.
Exactly, Joe. The galaxies are in motion. The stars are in motion. So something's moving them. And it just seemed to me that the plasma cosmology and electromagnetism is a better explanation for why things are in motion, how things are in motion, why they look the way they look. It just seems to me that plasma and electromagnetism explains that better than gravity and, well, whatever Danny Faulkner is basing his misunderstanding on.
And dark matter. You know, he's definitely a proponent of that dark matter is real.
Right.
And gravity is real, too. You know, I was surprised to hear that criticism that astronomy folks don't believe in gravity. That really surprised me.
Yeah, that's just that you. Professor Dave. You know, that's just total. Right. Yeah. He ate too many Cheetos in his basement.
Yes, thank you, Joe, for lifting us out of the criticism of Professor Dave. We do believe in gravity, yes. Okay, but we don't have, so despite the fact that we believe in gravity, we on the creationist side, Fred, we were talking earlier when we were getting ready and doing some research, how we don't really have a lot of astronomers, and maybe that's why Danny Faulkner has such a loud voice in our community.
Yeah, he's the only, for the longest time, he really was the only astronomer in creationdom, works for Answers in Genesis. You know, he's done a tremendous amount of good over the years, but he's been the only voice, and really, there has been nobody really to question him. Jason Lyle has come along as an astrophysicist, and in fact, he's got some criticisms of Satterfield's speed of light arguments that maybe Joe can elaborate on here in a second. But to your point, Doug, we need more voices in astronomy, because this article just shows really a lack of understanding of plasma cosmology from an astronomer who's really trying to criticize areas that he's just not an expert in at all. I'm going to take the word of of the scientist Scott, who's got a PhD in electrical engineering, wrote a textbook on it. He's very knowledgeable about electromagnetism, which is an important feature of electrical engineering. That's where I have my degree, even though I'm mostly do firmware now. And so you've got this bias, and you know, Max Planck had a famous quote about scientists, and Joe, I don't know if you have that handy. I think you reference it in your article.
Well, there's a paraphrase. The paraphrase is Max Planck said that science advances one funeral at a time. That's the pithy paraphrase, but the actual quote, a new scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and making them see the light, but rather because its opponents eventually die. and a new generation grows up that is familiar with it.
Yeah, it's, you know, we kind of feel like this, that same thing with the hydroplate theory, but you know,
right?
It reminds me, I wanted to bring this up because it just popped into my mind. So the president of RMCF is Rob Bracken, and he got his degree from Stanford in geophysics. And he's been a plate tectonics. He had been a plate tectonics believer for years. And then as a creationist, as a Christian, he came along and say, hey, you know, this catastrophic plate tectonics, that sounds really good. Cause now I can fit this in with my, you know, young earth beliefs as a Christian. I've come to realize the earth and the universe is really only about 6,000 years old. But over time, and I was having a conversation with Rob Bracken about this, he mentioned to me that over time, he just kept getting wore down and beat down by the all this evidence pouring in for the hydroplate theory. So Rob Bracken humbly admitted years of his education in promoting catastrophic plate tectonics, he came to the realization that, you know what, I'm wrong. And hydroplate theory just has so much evidence for it. And he changed his viewpoint. And I think that's just so a great testimony to Rob Bracken of his humbleness to realize, to let go of something that he believed for years. And for so many other people, it's just hard for them to let go of things that are so easily proven false over time. And that's why I thought it was appropriate for you to bring up Max Planck experienced the same thing in his time. And Joe, I like what you have in your article too. You mentioned how in Galileo's time, he had critics that did not want to believe him. In fact, Galileo said, they simply don't want to look through my telescope. They refuse to look through my telescope.
It would have been so easy to have looked and actually confirmed or disproven, or at least refuted, what Galileo was saying, but they didn't want to do that.
Yeah, they didn't want to look through his telescope. And it reminds me of this professor at Kansas State when Mary Schweitzer first published the soft tissue of dinosaur bones. He said that he refused to believe it. And she goes, well, what evidence would convince you? And he says, no evidence will convince me. I refuse to believe it. His mind was made up despite the evidence. And we've experienced that with the hydroplate theory where there is one example where Kevin Lee gave a book, Walt Brown's book, to one of the critics of the hydroplate theory and the creation, a young earth creationist. And he said he'd read the book, but eventually he got around to saying, well, I'm not going to read this book because basically his mind was already made up that it's wrong. How can you tell if something's wrong if you don't actually look into it and read it and admit that, hey, you know, maybe there is evidence for this that I should reconsider my position?
Yeah, and Fred, you know, that reminds me of the entire Christian worldview that's based on a book that an awful lot of people are afraid to even look at it or afraid to even consider it seriously and reasonably. They don't want to look at the Bible because it might conflict with the way they want to live their life and the way they want to believe. And so it takes a certain amount of humility to do that. And one of the best ways to understand humility is to understand the life and the work and the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And once you can accept that level of humility that he took upon himself, it can help us to humble ourselves, and it could help scientists maybe to humble themselves. So we encourage everyone out there to look into Jesus Christ, who he claimed to be, what history tells us he did, and the level of humility that the Most High God, the creator of the universe, was willing to experience himself. And then look in the mirror and ask yourself, can you humble yourself?
Yeah, I know there's going to be a lot of things I'm wrong about, and I know there's going to be things I'm biased about that I should have let go of. I just pray that I can see those, because we're all susceptible to it. All of us are. And I think that's, you know, one of the underlying problems, but I'm certainly not perfect. And it's great that, you know, that's what Real Science Radio, we try to look at all angles. And we, you know, Bob has been great over the years. He has an errata section, dedicated section to when, hey, I was wrong about this, or I misspoke about this, or I spoke on something that someone found out, hey, Bob, you said this and that's wrong. So he actually has an errata page, and I want to keep that going too. So listening audience, if you hear us say something that you know to be wrong, or you believe to be wrong. You don't have to even know it. You can say, I think that might not be right. Let us know, and we'll look into it and really hopefully and pray for, you know, pray that we are humble enough that if the evidence is there to pull back, to withdraw what we said on whatever topic it is. So,
amen. Amen. And so, Joe, I want to introduce this idea that plasma astronomy rejects general relativity. That's one of Faulkner's criticisms. Is that true?
No, I don't think so. Do you mean general or special relativity?
Faulkner states quite plainly that Scott, in his book, rejects general relativity.
Oh, I remember reading that. You know, I read Scott's book, and I don't recall anything about Scott rejecting general relativity, but I just don't know if he does or not, but I didn't get that, anything about that from the book.
But even if he does, which I do personally, but even if he does, it doesn't argue against plasma cosmology. He's off in the weeds on another topic.
Yeah, I was thinking that doesn't seem to be relevant.
So, Joe, we're getting low on time. I want to try to wrap this up real quickly. Can you briefly mention Jason Lyle's criticism? And you actually have an article on this that's already published that we'll definitely link to from the show summary. Mm-hmm. He has a specific criticism of basically the speed of light aspect of Satterfield's cosmology.
Yeah, Jason Lyle wrote an article titled Distant Starlight in a Young Universe, Attempted Solutions. So in that article, he talks about CDK, C being speed of light, DK referring to a decay or deterioration or degradation or slowdown of the speed of light. Since it was faster in the past, slowed down to the speed we measure today. Well, Lyle gives three arguments in that article against a faster speed of light in the past. So I don't know if we have time to deal with all of them here, but I did deal with all three of those arguments in an article on a website, and hopefully we can put a link in the show notes to that article.
Oh, absolutely, we will. And you know, it's a really good article. It's not real long. It has some technical parts, but you wrote it, I believe, in a real easy way for people to understand it and to see your argument that I think does a really good job of refuting what Jason Lyle said about the speed of light. It's an interesting read. So, Joe, if you could summarize maybe your one big point that sticks out that refutes Jason Lyle's idea.
Well, one of them was that a faster speed of light in the past would violate a law of physics, the conservation of energy, because E, energy, equals mc squared. But wait, C is a speed of light. So if C gets bigger, E would have to get bigger. But E cannot. E has to stay the same. Energy is conserved, not created or destroyed. Well, that whole argument is based on an assumption that as the C got bigger, the M would stay the same in E equals mc squared. But that's an assumption that M is a constant there. Mm-hmm. So actually, I went through some math and derived mathematically that if C increased, according to Satterfield's model, M would decrease in precisely the way to cancel each other out. So energy would not change.
Yeah, and we'll provide a link to your article on that. I think it's done really well. You've got the math to show and references of, you know, that this assumption that mass cannot change, that's not a correct assumption. If that assumption goes away, then their argument goes away. And I thought you did a really good job of refuting it. It's a fairly brief article, but easy for the layperson to understand.
I'm sure Lyle would know this. All astrophysicists would know this, that according to Einstein's relativity theory, mass changes all over the place. It changes all the time. And there's an equation describing it. As mass travels faster and faster, it gets larger. It shouldn't be too surprising if mass would change.
Yeah. That's really cool, Joe. So the other aspect was he had some speed of light argument about how a supernova exploded and it sent light to a gas cloud. And then when we measure the speed of light and look at it from this distant past and how it arrives at Earth, he made an argument that doesn't fit. And help me here, Joe, the geometry behind it. And you've got an article also that refutes that.
Yes. And it would be really great if you, the audience could look at the diagrams and see what's going on.
Yeah. And we'll link to that.
We'll definitely link. Yeah. We'll definitely link to that. And so, Joe, to help me understand what you just said about E equals MC squared. So if C appears to be declining, right?
Mm-hmm.
So M being the fabric of the universe, being the ZPE, being the virtual particle pairs in the universe, that fabric is just getting thicker over time. Am I understanding that properly?
Well, if C is declining over time, I wouldn't say it is the ZPE. I'd say it is affected by the ZPE, which probably was what you meant.
But right. It's a little hard for a layman to kind of wrap our head around the whole concept, but it's almost as if the soup is getting thicker, and so the light's having a harder time moving through the soup.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And not just the light, but electrical processes are also being slowed by the soup.
Right. But for Lyle to say that light is decaying, that's kind of a misapplication, or that's a misinterpretation of what's happening, or maybe a better way to say it would be that is an unintentional misrepresentation of what's happening.
Yeah. Well, because we mentioned this, I think on the prior show, there's a misunderstanding in creationdom that of Barry Setterfield when he says light decays. We don't want there to be a picture of like how a grape decays into a prune or a raisin or whatever, you know, or something just deteriorates. And like me right now, I'm getting older, I'm decaying. We're not saying that light is like decaying, it's getting weaker. What we're saying is it goes at different speeds in different mediums. If you got a pure vacuum, we agree the speed of light would be constant. But if you've got a vacuum with more stuff in it, more gravel in it, and actually zero-point energy or virtual particles, it's going to travel slower through that medium. It didn't really decay. It traveled slower.
Yeah, the speed of light would be constant in a medium that has constant properties, permeability and permittivity. It's only when those properties of the medium change that the speed of light would change.
Ah, that's helpful. That's helpful. I can get my head around that. Thank you, Joe.
All right. So we're going to link again to Joe's articles that refute Danny Faulkner. Now, that's not quite ready for publication, but I think, Joe, you're getting pretty close with that, right?
I've been working on it.
Yeah. So hopefully you'll have that pretty soon. We'll get, when we get that, we'll put it in the show summary, because a lot of times people can just go to rsr.org. You know, maybe we'll call this segment rsr.org/plasma, and you go to the page. You can always go to it, anytime and find out the latest. We like to try to keep things updated on the different discoveries that happen with regard, whether it's a hydroplate theory or in this case plasma, or maybe we've got some new, not so old item that we'll add to that list. We'll make sure that once you have that article ready, we'll link to it. I think it's a really good refutation, and I'm hoping when you have that ready, I'll share it with Danny Faulkner. And, maybe at some point Answers in Genesis can update their article, because that it shows up early in Google searches, this Faulkner criticism, and it's just an article that they should ideally take down, because it's just almost, there's so many problems with it. But creationists are going to be misled when they read it, that he might actually have a point, which he doesn't, So anyway, any closing thoughts, Doug, Joe, as we wrap up the Barry Setterfield Cosmology series?
Well, I just want to thank Joe for helping me and hopefully helping the audience better understand the Setterfield Cosmology big picture, and just look very much forward to the evidence as the observable evidence comes out, as we look more closely at the universe. Hopefully, Joe's put us all in a better position to understand it and to be humble where we're proven incorrect. Really appreciate it, Joe.
Well, thank you. I appreciate being a guest here and being able to share this. It's been fun.
Joe, I think you might want to end by thanking Barry Setterfield.
Oh, yes, yes.
Well, Joe, I actually want you to say.
He's a brilliant guy. He's got really, his math is really solid. I mean, you know, we're not always right on all of, you know, like you do the math to try to support your argument, and sometimes you might find little errors here and there. And Barry Satterfield is a really bright person. He's really good at math. And, you know, he's had a few slight things he's had to correct here and there, but he himself is shown to be humble. And his theories has just withstood the test of time from what I could see and all the criticisms I read of it and his responses to them. Mm-hmm. And just kudos to Barry Satterfield on what is really a fascinating idea and I think a really good way to deal with the starlight problem. I wanted one last thought I want to stick in here, and I know we're past time, and so I realize the radio audience at this point is listening online. I thank you for doing that. And that's this question a guy brought up on CRSNet is how do we see the stars that explode in Revelation? And I think Satterfield's model could explain that. It's something to contemplate on, you know, as a listening audience. If you have any thoughts on that, I just musing on Satterfield's ideas, I can see how, you know, God could, you know, he could change that 0 point energy to allow, because if it's really low, if it's thin, like Joe said, that light can get here really quick. And God just needs to change that if he wanted to. Or you could look at it, and I think, Joe, you mentioned this, the translation of of that phrasing in Revelation, that those could be asteroids too. Those very things that Walt Brown said came from Earth and are, you know, every now and then come down and come back to Earth. Anyways, I guess that was a last stand on my soapbox. I loved having you, Joe. We've talked about this show for some time. Barry Satterfield was going to do the show, but his health didn't permit it. I want to reference everybody back to our Constance show that we did last year, about 6 months ago. Go to rsr.org/Constance, and you'll hear what was supposed to set up this show about how the fundamental constants, there's evidence that they've been changing, such as the Planck constant, which seems to inversely change with the speed of light having changed over time, and the evidence that for that is presented on that show.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yep. So thanks again, Joe and Doug, as always. Always fun to go through the science that supports the evidence of the Creator. His invisible attributes are clearly seen. And faith,
amen.
What is faith according to the Bible?
Faith is the evidence of things not seen and the substance of things hoped for.
Wow, the evidence of things not seen, like gravity and plasma. I guess we can see plasma, but 0 point energy, the evidence of things not seen. So it's so cool talking about that. And again, one last thanks to Mr. Joe Spears. Really appreciate all you do for Real Science Radio. And for Doug McBurney, this is Fred Williams of Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Talking about.